Still places to look, if you know what I mean.
I don't, Wade said.
Sir? I don't know.
Lux paused.
Well, places.
There was a sound on the line that Wade took to be someone else's voice. After a second, Lux asked if he could speak with Claude. Wade handed the phone over. He stood awkwardly at the center of the kitchen, off balance, wondering if there was something he should be doing or saying, some overlooked gesture. Tears, maybe, except he was tired of pretending. He went to the refrigerator, took out a tray of ice cubes, built himself a vodka tonic. Pat's low crying irritated him. It seemed profoundly wrong. When all was lost, he thought the thing to do was grab a hammer or mix a drink. Like father, like son. In a few minutes, Claude hung up and motioned at Wade. They went out to the living room. The old man looked very tired.
"Whole thing's ridiculous," he said. "But I guess you know what's going to happen."
"Pretty much."
"I can't say no."
"That's fine." Claude slumped on the couch, massaged the pouches under his eyes.
"Wouldn't help none anyway. Either way, they'll rip this place apart. They got this idea, you know, they figure probably she's around here somewhere. The boathouse, on the grounds."
"She's not," Wade said.
"But it doesn't matter."
"Fucking does matter. I just wish..."
The old man closed his eyes. Watching him, Wade was struck by the notion that he had a genuine friend in the world. Unique development, he thought. Claude blinked and looked up pensively from the couch.
"A situation, isn't it?"
"That's what it is," Wade said.
"No win, no tie. They don't find anything, you're still a sinner. After what happened with the election, all the garbage that leaked out..."
The old man looked at Wade's drink.
"You mind?"
Wade gave him the glass. They were quiet for a time, passing the drink. Then Claude reached out and put a hand on Wade's knee.
"I don't want to be sappy. She was all you had, right?"
"Yes."
"And you didn't do zilch."
"I did things. Not that."
"Right."
Claude took his hand away.
"And there ain't nothing else, you know, nothing else you can say?"
"There never was."
"Naturally. That's what I keep telling people. Guy yells wolf, he gets stuck with the mistake, can't say a goddamn thing to change anybody's mind."
The old man sighed and finished off the drink.
"Same with how you've been acting, right? No use blubbering, wouldn't help a bit."
"Maybe that's it," Wade said. "You get tired of the politics."
Claude nodded.
"Which is how I'd handle it. The same. Let the bastards think what they want."
The old man got up and went to the kitchen and came back with two tall drinks. He switched on a lamp, but even so, the cottage had the feel of a funeral home. They didn't speak. Outside in the woods, a pair of owls were having their own conversation. Claude finally sighed.
"Well, anyhow, I guess you won't want to be here for the festivities when they tear things up. There's the car. You could head back to the cities. Just sit tight. Right now, you're still free to go."
"You know I can't do that."
"I'll want a boat, Claude."
"Sure you will.
Gasoline?
A full tank?"
"Not for me. We've been all through that. I don't need two good clients out there."
"And the chart book?"
"I'm sorry."
"I'll find a way."
"Yeah, no doubt."
Claude looked up with his tired old crow eyes. It occurred to Wade that the man was not well.
"No lie, Senator. I am sorry. Conscience and all that. Get to be my age. A guy needs his sleep at night."
He took out a red hanky and ran it across his forehead.
"You understand?"
"Yes, of course. How much time do I have?"
"Day after tomorrow. Or the day after that. Lux has got the state police coming up. Criminal investigator types.
Couple sniffer dogs.
Lovely, Wade said.
It had to happen.
Sure it did. Wade winked. Senator. I like that.
By morning, the snow had mostly melted, and the temperature was up in the high 40s. They spent the day out on the lake, searching north and northeast of Magnuson's Island. There were no other boats out. No aircraft, no motion at all. On occasion, the sun appeared low over the horizon, yet even then the sky had a dull, grayish cast that seemed to take its color from their mood. The tensions were beyond coping. No one bothered. Pat sat like a rock at the rear of the boat. She wouldn't look at him, or even through him. When necessary, she addressed her remarks to the lake. Wade preferred it that way. His own thoughts had mellowed. Certain burdens had already been put down. Others soon would be. He regarded the lake without terror. One thing he'd learned, the world had its own sneaky little tricks. Over the past days, despite everything, the lost election had come to seem almost a windfall. He felt lighter inside, nothing left to hide. Tuan Yen was still there, of course, and always would be. But the horror now was outside him, ugly and pitiful and public. No less evil, he thought, but at least the demands of secrecy were gone, which was another of nature's sly tricks. Once you're found out, you don't tremble at being found out. The trap door drops open. All you can do is fall gracefully and far and deep. And soon other issues would be settled. Sanity, for instance. Courage for another. Love for a last. He gazed out at a pair of small islands passing by. For the first time in many years, maybe ever, he felt a sense of sureness about himself. At 3 o'clock, Claude pulled up to the docks in Angle Inlet to take on fuel. They walked up to Pearson's Texaco station, where Wade excused himself and crossed the street. In the mini-mart, he purchased 2 loaves of bread, sandwich meats, 1/5 of vodka, a large tourist map, 3 cans of Sterno, and a small plastic compass endorsed by the Boy Scouts of America. The plump girl behind the counter gave him a long look as he paid. Myra something. Albino blood. Very nosy. The idea came to him that he should bare his teeth, but instead he wished her a pleasant day and walked out with the goods. His dreams that night, as he would remember them, were situated inside a chrome computer. He'd crawled in through a manhole. He was demanding a recount. Arithmetic! He was yelling. But the computer made a coughing noise that turned into a deep, mocking purr. All the wires were tangled. The circuitry was composed of electric eels, and there were colorful fish and liquid poisons and numerous examples of evil. When he awoke, the hour was approaching dawn. He dressed in clean corduroys, cotton socks, a white flannel shirt, a finely woven cashmere sweater that Kathy had presented to him on a Christmas Eve not so long ago. He rolled up a pair of blankets. An old sheet, too. There were traces of early light as he moved down the hallway to the kitchen. It was no great surprise to find the boat key lying squarely at the center of the formica table. Alongside was an envelope. He pocketed these items, put on a pair of rubber boots, picked up his provisions, and walked down the slope to the dock. He felt no special sentiment. A misled life, nothing else.
Kath, oh Kath, he thought.
It was impossible to conceive of her as dead, simply lost, among the missing. In the frail dark, he stepped into the Chris Craft and secured his things. A little dazed, a little dreamy. After all the lies, a couple of minor truths had now appeared. Or whatever the certainty was that held his heart when he thought, Kath, my Kath. He untied the mooring ropes. He started up the engine, felt the boat rise and take to the water. 100 yards out, he looked back at the small yellow cottage on the slope above the lake. Love, he thought, which was one truth. You couldn't lose it even if you tried. He took out his new compass and swung the boat north. Later, when he looked back, the yellow cabin was gone.
But even then, in his mind's eye, he could see a man and a woman lying quietly on a porch in the dense night fog, wrapped in blankets, holding each other, pretending things were not so bad. He could hear their voices as they took turns thinking up names for the children they wanted. Funny names, sometimes, so they could laugh. And he could hear them planning the furnishings for their new house, the fine rugs they would buy, the antique brass lamps, the exact colors of the wallpaper, all the details. Verona, Kathy said. And then they talked about Verona, the things they would see and do. And soon the fog was all around them and inside them, and they were swallowed up and gone. Not a footprint, not a single clue. All woods and water. A place where 1 + 1 always came to 0. Chapter 24. Hypothesis. Or maybe she'd left him long ago, in the summer of 1983, when she flew off to meet Harmon in Boston. In the years that followed, she had mostly kept the secret inside, where it was like a weight that had to be carried through her life and marriage. And maybe one day it became too much for her. Not just the affair, everything. A decayed marriage, deferred dreams, withheld intimacies. For all these years, even before the fling with Harmon, there had been an ever-widening distance between the life she wanted and the life she had. Suicide? Impossible to know. Certainly the pressures were enormous. She was on Valium and Restoril. The ruins were everywhere. Her husband, the election, the unborn child in her heart. So maybe she'd planned it, or half-planned it, taking the boat out and aiming it straight north and losing herself forever in Lake of the Woods. At some point on a rocky beach, perhaps, in the dark, she might have found herself cataloging the events that had conspired to bring her here. The disappointments, the slow strangulation by politics. How the affair with Harmon had started almost by accident, a chance meeting, a few casual letters, and how after 4 months it had ended the same way, without choice or volition, as if she were strapped into the back seat of her own life. And what had changed? Still out of control, still at the whim of a world that seemed aligned against her. The sadness was crushing. How things were, how things could have been. Maybe she had already swallowed the medications, or maybe she did it now, with plenty of lake water, then sat down again and let her thoughts skip back to the Boston airport. Harmon meeting her there. The drive north along the coast of Maine to a resort called Loon Point, where they'd spent 4 days and 3 nights, and where on the morning of the 4th day after breakfast she had informed him that it was over. A mistake, she'd said. She loved her husband. She remembered Harmon's round, white face, a dentist's face, concentrating. Well, he'd said. Nothing else. And now it was all a mystery. She couldn't recall the color of the man's eyes, or how she had come to care about him, or what had happened to wake her up. The whole affair struck her as something quaint and foreign. She remembered how they'd gone dancing one night at Loon Point, how adventurous it had seemed, how the music and starlight and danger had stirred her to feel close to him, almost giddy with pleasure, but how in a curious way it was not really Harmon in her arms, it was the idea of happiness, the possibility, the temptation, a slow, tantalizing waltz with some handsome future. For a few minutes maybe, Kathy looked out across the lake and allowed herself to cry. Or maybe the drugs were at work, a nice dark calm tugging her down. The flight back to Minneapolis was a blur now, a mostly empty jet, a couple of martinis. It had been late afternoon when she carried her suitcase into the apartment and put it down, and stood listening to the quiet. She remembered pouring herself a glass of wine. She remembered filling the bathtub, slipping in, soaking there for a long while. At 6 o'clock, she'd moved out to the kitchen to start supper. A half hour later, when John walked in, she'd fixed her eyes elsewhere, adjusting the heat on her electric skillet, using a spatula to drop on 3 pork chops. John had come up behind her,
The Globetrotter, he'd said, and kissed her neck, his fingers briefly squeezing the inch or two of loose flesh at her waist. It was a habit she disliked. It made her feel fat. But she remembered a quick rush of gratitude. Immediately, by the pressure of his fingers, she knew he had no inkling. They'd eaten supper in front of the TV. During the commercials, in a voice she recognized as politely forced, he'd asked a few vague questions about the trip. He was interested in the airline food, the weather, the high school friend she'd been visiting. She had kept her answers short. The friend was a bore, the weather hot, the food poisonous. John had nodded at the TV. It was all too easy. At one point, she'd apologized to him about the foul-up. "Foul-up?" he'd said. "You know, the flight." "No kidding?" She'd glanced over at him. "I was due in tomorrow. I explained how..." "You didn't get the message?"
"Whoops," he'd said, and grinned at her. "Never checked the machine."
She remembered staring at her plate. The pork chops had left a fleshy, rancid taste on her tongue. Stupidly, without calculation, she was seized by the need to retaliate. What she should have done, she thought, was to call in a message describing the dance floor at Loon Point, the cozy hotel room, the wallpaper, the bedspread, all the details. She remembered carrying her plate into the kitchen, rinsing it off, moving out to the tiny back patio, and just standing there in the leaden twilight. He would never know. Not the specifics. The secret was safe. Yet, in the evening air, like a blank tape, there was the hum of a terrifying question. Does any of it really matter? Which then deepened into the sound of an imperfect, infinitely approximate answer. Who knows? She remembered opening her robe to the humid night air. There was a huge and desperate wanting in her heart. Wanting without object. Pure wanting. Later, John had come out.
"Hey, gorgeous," he'd said, and stood beside her in the heavy twilight. "So you had fun? A good trip?"
She remembered pulling her robe tight, turning toward him without contrition or clues. "Fine," she'd said. Maybe in the end she blamed herself, not for the affair so much, but for the waning of energy, the slow year-by-year fatigue that had finally worn her down. She had stopped trying. She had given up on squirt guns. She had forfeited her dreams, and the fling with Harmon was just an emblem of all the unhappiness in her life. Maybe there were secret forces she could not tolerate. Maybe memory, maybe drugs. Maybe in Lake of the Woods, where all is repetition, she whispered, "Why?" And then closed her eyes and sank into the sound of the endless answer, "Who knows? Who ever knows?" Chapter 25. Evidence.
"Reminds me of those three monkeys. The man didn't hear nothing, didn't smell nothing, didn't see nothing. He sure as shit did something."
Vincent R. Vinnie Pearson.
"Ridiculous. Mr. Wade loved his wife. Anybody could see that. Just like Claude and me."
Ruth Rasmussen.
"All I know is they come into the mini-mart awful unhappy. They sat there unhappy. They left unhappy. That's all I know."
Myra Shaw, waitress.
"I don't make guesses."
Arthur J. Lux, sheriff, Lake of the Woods County.
"I had prayed to God that this thing was fiction."
Colonel William V. Wilson, U.S. Army investigator.
"Exhibit 10, photographs 12 of victims at Tuan Yen. Date? 16 March 1968. Photographer, Ronald Hayburl."
The attitude of all the men, the majority I would say, was a revengeful attitude. Gregory T. Olson, 1st Platoon, Charlie Company.
"People were talking about killing everything that moved. Everyone knew what we were going to do."
Robert W. Pendleton, 3rd Platoon, Charlie Company.
"Vice never sees its own ugliness. If it did, it would be frightened by its own image.
Shakespeare's Iago, who behaves in a way that's true to his nature, sounds false because he is forced by our dramatic conventions to unmask himself, to himself be the one to lay bare the secrets of his complex and crooked heart. In reality, man seldom tramples his conscience underfoot so casually. George Sand, Indiana. We were all psyched up.